I have no clue. We have food for our dog, two different kinds. One is inch-long big bits that are meant to clean his teeth and save us monstrous cleaning bills from the vet. And he hates them. And then there's the other food that he really likes. And so we mix them together. We're so crafty. And put them all in one bowl. And he just roots around in the big bits. You know, they're thrown out. And all the other stuff is eaten. And then when the good stuff is gone, he has a routine with the big bits. He will take them from his bowl one at a time. Bring them next to me. Drop it, especially on the floor, is best. Look down, and then he will crunch loud. It just sounds like a jackhammer going off right next. Conversations stop while he eats one bit. There's 30 of them in the bowl. Goes back, gets one more, brings it, drops it, and eats it. I'm not sure he's getting exercised as I get exercised, but aside from annoying me, there is no other reasonable explanation for his habit pattern, unless perhaps he's devious. Passive-aggressive behavior that I will just put down to being a strange behavior pattern from my dog. Dog spelled backwards is God. Now, that's a terrible transition, but I thought I'd try it. Have you ever thought that that God might have some strange behavior patterns? That God would do things that would raise an eyebrow or cause you to furrow both of them? I found one in the Bible, a curious action. It's located in the book of Genesis, at the creation story, chapter 2, with what appears to be a summary of creation at the beginning of that chapter. It says this: "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their hosts. By the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done. And then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all the work which God had created and made." Now, if you were to go to Bible school and take a theology 101 class, one of the things that they would teach you is that God is omnipotent, which is an egghead way of saying that he is all-powerful all the time. So when you think about that, it means it would just stand to reason that God doesn't get tired, that he cannot get tired. That being true, it raises the question, why did God need to rest? And the answer is, he didn't need to rest. He just did. And what is profound about God resting on the seventh day comes but in the fact that we are created in his image, meaning that God has established a pre-designed pattern that has been wired into our DNA of all of those who have been created in his image. And the pattern is 6 and 1. Work 6 days, rest one. Work 6 days, rest one. If you work 5 days and rest two, it means you've got more work to do. If you work 7 and rest zero, it means that you will burn out because you have violated the pattern. Working 6 and resting 1 is the pattern that God has built into us as human beings in order for us to function in the way that we were created, in an ideal fashion. It's meant to be, it's been wired into our DNA, and it's meant to allow for maximum productivity and full restoration. Work 6, rest 1. Work 6, rest 1. Now the question that comes now and jumps right into the middle of our story is, okay then, what then is work? What am I to rest from? If you know or have heard or read anything about the Pharisees, you know that they felt it was their sworn duty to come up with all of these rules that would make sure that none of the Jews broke the Sabbath by working in any way. And you can see why they were exercised about this when you realize that it's one of the Ten Commandments and it's the longest of them, with reasons given for it and everything. So that in Exodus chapter 20, verse 8 to 11, it says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shall you labor and do all of your work, but on the seventh day it's a Sabbath to the Lord your God." Did you? There's that pattern again. Oh my word. "In it you shall do no work." And then it lists off all the people who can't do work, your sons, your daughter, your wife or wives, your animals. If there's a guest in your house and they ask for the internet password so that they can do work on their computer, you say no. And the reason is in verse 11. "Because in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea that is and all that is in them and rested on the seventh day." There's the pattern again. And what you notice is mentioned in both of these things is that you're not supposed to do is work. No work. So no working on the Sabbath, which again begs the question, how do we understand this idea of work on the Sabbath? Now there are two ways that we can approach this matter. The first is the way of the Pharisees, which was to define what is forbidden to do on the Sabbath. The Pharisees were the aforementioned fundamentalist sect of Judaism, and they had taken it upon themselves to grab this Exodus 20 verse 8 law and to interpret it into a whole bunch of other things that you cannot do, so that even if they sniffed of work, you could not do them. And they ended up with reams of rules. But in their unrealistic vigilance, they had created this monstrous system of rules that you could not follow it and stay alive and be human at the same time. Specifically, they had concocted not 39 laws, but 39 categories of laws of what would be classified as work. For example, they tackled the subject of writing and said you cannot write two letters on the Sabbath or erase one of them. You can only write one letter. If you write two, it's work. If you erase one, it's work. So if you accidentally wrote two letters, you were really hooped because you had written two and you couldn't erase one of them, right? If you're texting right now and you've texted more than two letters, according to the Pharisees, you've broken the Sabbath. Now, in past education, I had to read all of these Pharisees' laws, and I cannot recall offhand where hashtag fit in their thing. Like, is it a letter? Is it two letters? Is it considered a symbol? And because there's lots of symbols in the temple, we let that one go. But those are the kind of dumb things that they would debate about. All kinds of laws about writing. And ironically, these laws were written for a culture that was largely illiterate. That's silly. The rules were so insanely oppressive. Can you imagine they come up with a new rule and say you're not allowed to write more than one letter, and you rejoice because you're illiterate. Finally, I couldn't write a letter to save my life, but finally there's a way that I don't have to break the Sabbath, right? In addition, you can't take, or you couldn't take, anything from one domain to another. So you're going to take muffins to your neighbor to be nice because they just moved in. No. You're outside sitting in the lounge and your neighbor's football bounces, or kid's football bounces over the fence at your feet. Throw it back. No. Forbidden. Verboten. That sounds even better, the German version of it. You could not travel more than a Sabbath day journey, which is just a little over half a mile, which means that most, if not all of us, have broken the Sabbath today just because of the distance that we traveled. You say, "I haven't texted a word today." No, but you drove to church. If I had lived back then, I would have measured a Sabbath day journey and bought the land and built a great big hotel and rented out rooms the night before the Sabbath and made a fortune on this stupid law. I mean, it's crazy. Impossible to live by. I guess in Roman captivity, there were so few things left to define the Jews as Jews. There was circumcision. I don't think the Pharisees really wanted to do a spot inspections on that one, just to make sure that there was compliance. And so they figured that they are going to take the Sabbath and they are going to make people keep that law to the T, which being one letter doesn't even break the law either. So there was two ways to do this. One is ridiculous laws, and I've just touched on them, believe me. The second approach is Jesus' approach, which is to define the Sabbath by all of the graces that we allow God to work in our lives. Instead of us working, we allow the grace of God to work in our lives. And the difference is huge. It's observance based on blessings received rather than work forbidden. And the difference between the two, between Jesus and the Pharisees, is the difference between abundantly received grace and ill-defined law. Between abundantly received grace and ill-defined law. We see these two contrasting approaches unfolding in the two stories this morning, where Jesus is judged for either what he has condoned, because he's responsible for his disciples, or for what he has done, and he's judged by Pharisees who have these strict laws. But I want us to notice in each of the stories that we read, the life-giving grace of God that is given to those who keep the Sabbath. Naturally, the first instance has to happen on the Sabbath. Jesus and his disciples had gone to church, which was their pattern, by the way, and should probably inform our pattern as his disciples if we claim to follow him. But it was after church. They were on their way home. And Jesus' disciples, like children in the service who need a constant supply of Cheerios to keep their mouths shut or stomachs full, had got none of them. And they were hungry. So as they walked by a field that was probably ripe with either barley or wheat, they just grabbed some heads of grain and rubbed them between their hands to separate the seed from the husks, and they were eating this. But that action under extreme and powerful prejudiced microscopes could be defined as thrashing or harvesting. If done in bulk, it would be, if you do one, you're harvesting and breaking the law in the minds of the Pharisees. Now, the chances are good that the Pharisees didn't regularly police, the adjacent farmers' fields for Sabbath violators, second careers as wheat-thrashing Nazis. Instead, they probably followed Jesus out of the temple in hopes of catching him, breaking one of their laws. Maybe on the way out they overheard someone, one of Jesus' disciples, probably Peter, saying, "Me hungry." And they knew Peter's not going to make it home. They're probably going to go by some fields. And so they figured their chance of catching him at a supposed offense had greatly increased, and they were right. The disciples ate the seeds of grain that they had worked to dislodge. And the text doesn't say that Jesus ate any. It only says that the Pharisaic paparazzi said to him of them, "Look, your disciples do what is not lawful on the Sabbath." And again, as I said before, he as a teacher was responsible for their actions. And yet Jesus counters them masterfully by using the Old Testament against those who felt themselves Old Testament experts. That's just a wonderful thing to do when somebody thinks they're so smart on something and you beat them on the thing they're smart on. You go wonder if Jesus ever did the foot, that kind of thing when he got them. What Jesus does is he gives the example of David, who when he and his companions were fleeing from mad King Saul, who was mad in every sense of the word, they became hungry from running and they ate bread that only the priests from the tabernacle were allowed to lawfully eat. Jesus' description, if you compare the two, is even bolder than the original one in 1 Samuel 21. In 1 Samuel 21, Ahimelech, the high priest, has the bread brought out to them. In Jesus' story, he has David go right into the temple and grab the loaves himself. The Old Testament story doesn't mention that it was the Sabbath. But later, Jewish interpreters says that it was probably the Sabbath, because Leviticus 24:8 says that that was the day when the showbread, or the bread of the presence, was replaced and brought out to them. They got the old stuff, in other words. But David and his men are being given the old bread, which should have still only been eaten by the priests on the Sabbath. And the reason why they got it is because he and his men were hungry. They needed compassion. Skip down to verse 7, where after recalling this statement, Jesus said to the Pharisees, "But if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent." And in Jesus' response to the Pharisees' judgment, he, rather than defining Sabbath in terms of work not done, defines it in terms of blessings freely received. And the first blessing that he says that those who observe the Sabbath receive is a satisfaction of our basic needs. From abstract to concrete, Sabbath is a time to allow God to work to satisfy basic needs in your life. Well, basic needs like what? Well, the first question in the old Westminster Catechism is this: what is the chief end of man? What would be the most satisfying thing for us to do considering how we have been made? What is the most basic need that God has created us with? And the answer is, the chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. And the Sabbath gives you opportunity in worship to satisfy that deep innate need to connect with God, to glorify Him in worship, to enjoy His presence and His goodness, His glory and His grace. Sabbath being a time when we allow God to work in us to satisfy our basic needs. Furthermore, we've been created with social needs. God said that it is not good for man or woman to be alone, meaning that we have been created with a basic need to connect with others. It doesn't necessarily mean marriage, but it means friendship or community. And gathering here on a Sunday offers us that, because for a day we don't have to compete with others. For a day we don't have to watch our backs. For a day we don't have to manage or be managed by somebody else. For a day we can enjoy community, not as competitors or reports or bosses, but as brothers and sisters in Christ, allowing Jesus, the Lord of the Sabbath, to satisfy our deep need to be in meaningful community. Third, if you were to take Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, in terms of importance, you've probably seen this before, but in terms of importance, the bottom level, the rest don't matter if you don't do the bottom one, is physiological needs. Breathing, sleeping, water, and food. And in this story, Jesus had provided food for his disciples during the Sabbath. Very basic need. Walked along the roadway. I think he chose it on purpose because there's food there. They were hungry and could just take it. He had done all of the work, or God had done all of the work to allow the crops to flourish. All they had to do was take it. In other words, they didn't have to work for it at all. You know, if you read the works of those who have thought long and deep about Sabbath, like, for example, Abraham Joshua Heschel, who wrote just a small book on the Sabbath that is just a gem. He's a Jewish rabbi, but this is just a wonderful piece. I've probably read it half a dozen times. or a book by Marva Dawn called Keeping the Sabbath Holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y. They both observe, having thought about this for a long time, that Sabbath is a day of complete trust that God will meet your needs, and therefore it is a day in which you intentionally do not work so that you can trust God to meet your needs. Food, water, shelter, graciously supplied, while we trust in Him by intentionally doing nothing. So the first thing we see, the first blessing we receive from keeping the Sabbath, is that Jesus satisfies our most basic need. There's a second blessing that we can receive from the Lord of the Sabbath as we keep His Sabbath, and it's of course in the second scene that we read. The scene moves from outdoors to indoors, from walking along the side of a field to sitting in the synagogue. And there are four constants, which is a lot, I guess. Jesus, His disciples, the Pharisees, and someone who had a need. Verse 10 says that there was a man in the congregation who had a withered hand. The question some scholars debate is whether that man was a plant. Not a petunia, but someone who had been purposely placed there by the Pharisees in order to get Jesus' attention. So they say to each other, let's sit him here where Jesus will be sure to see him and see if we can sucker Jesus into contradicting our interpretation of the law, and then we can nab him. Their interpretation of the law being that it is not lawful to heal someone on the Sabbath unless it is a matter of life and death. So if you're walking along the road and you see someone bleeding out, it's a Sabbath, you maybe have to measure how much blood is out, whether he's going to last till Monday before you infuse him, that kind of thing. Withered hand, on the other hand, it can wait. But if we can get him to contradict our interpretation, we've got him. Sure enough, Jesus sees the man and they ask him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And their intention is also stated by Matthew, so that they might accuse him, obviously based on his response. Now, whereas last time Jesus used the Old Testament to show the Pharisees the error of their thinking about Sabbath, this time he uses logic. And you can label the logical movement as lesser to greater. A lesser to greater argument. Watch how he does it. We'll use a balance to show it. At first, he answers their question with a question, which is such a rabbi thing to do. Remember hearing the story of a group of students. Rabbi was teaching them, and one student asked the rabbi, how come you always answer a question with a question? And the rabbi said, what's wrong with questions? Right? So Jesus is going to do that to them. They ask him a question, and he's going to ask them a question back with a foregone conclusion that is going to set up for him a slam dunk. The leading question with a foregone conclusion was this: what man is there among you who has a sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will he not take hold of it and lift it out? And the answer was, all of them would do that. Anybody in the room who had a sheep who fell in the pit would pull it out on the Sabbath, because the sheep were of relative importance. On the other hand, they were just common animals, right? They were used for sacrifices, 50,000 a year sacrificed, 150,000 a year eaten, so they're just kind of food. And then comes the punchline, and watch the lesser to greater argument. How much more valuable then is man than a sheep? And in asking that question, Jesus has them hook, line, and downrigger. Because men are of greater value than sheep, and they knew it. If you would rescue your sheep on the Sabbath, you only need enough breath to fog a mirror to know that you should surely heal this man. And in verse 13, Jesus heals the man's hand. And here we see the second blessing that can be received from observing the Sabbath given by the Lord of the Sabbath. And that is this: healing for the hurting. Healing for the hurting. Now, during Communion Sundays, we have experienced people healed as the elders pray. From physical, mental illness. People have been healed because they kept the Sabbath and allowed Jesus to touch them where they hurt. Sometimes it has been miraculous. Sometimes it has been medicinal. Sometimes doctors have been given remarkable diagnostic insight into what has been wrong. Sometimes people are granted quicker than expected healing from surgeries or sickness. But it's happened as a blessing overflowing from observing the Sabbath. Being present for God to do His work in you by healing you where you hurt. Shriveled hands are not so prominent today as they were back then. Outer hurts are not as visible today in the days of hospitals and advances in medicine and treatment. But I believe that in the place of shriveled hands and that need healing, we have a whole lot of shriveled hearts and souls. Inner hurts that no one can really point to and say, oh, that's fairly obvious. No, I can't really tell. Anxieties, depression, grief, fears, separations that need the healing touch of the Lord of the Sabbath. The work that He wants to do while you do none. That's why I moved the prayer time to the end. Because Sabbath is not only a time to give God worship and praise that He deserves, but it is also a time to admit that you cannot do it alone and to rest in His love for you and His desire to bring healing to your body, mind, and spirit, to allow Him to be the one who works on that day in your life. 6 days we work for God. The seventh is a day in which we allow God to work in us. And if you need God to touch you, to have God work in you today, I would invite you to come as we sing together and the prayer teams are going to come and ask prayer for that person, to prayer team person, to pray for you or with you about anything that is troubling you, because it's Sabbath. It's the day when God can do a work in your heart. Rather than working today, would you be willing to allow God to work in your life this Sabbath? If so, why don't you come and pray with someone as we sing together?
Let's stand.